Exactly what part he played, I'm not sure. He's pretty good at keeping secrets. That's part of his problem. He keeps it all inside. You do that too much, and it's like cancer. Like acid or something. It eats you up. It's eating him up. And this crap in the papers has made it a lot worse. All I can say, Doc, is this. I don't know a better man than your husband, and I've been around the block a few times. He's put it on the line more than the times you know about. But there's people around who don't like him very much, and those people are trying to get him in a way that he can't deal with. It's typical, dirty, underhanded crap, but Jack's not the kind of guy who can deal with that. He plays by the rules, you see. So it's eating him up. Kathy was weeping now. Clark handed her a handkerchief. I figured you should know. If you think it's necessary, I want you to check it out as much as you think you have to. That's your decision. And I want you to make the call without worrying about me or Ding or anybody else, okay? I'll take you to see Carol Zimmer and the kids. If I lose my job, the hell with it. I've been in the business too damn long anyway. Christmas presents? For the Zimmer kids? Yeah. I helped wrap them. Your husband can't wrap presents worth a damn, but I suppose you know that. I even delivered some of my own. My two were too grown up for fun presents, and they're great kids, the Zimmers. It's nice being an uncle. John added with a genuine smile. All a lie? I don't know about the financial stuff, just the other things. And they tried to get at him through you, judging by what you just said. The tears stopped at that moment. Kathy wiped her eyes and looked up. You're right. You said you don't know who's doing this? I'm planning to find out. Clark promised her. Her demeanor had changed completely. This was some broad. I want you to let me know. And I want to meet the Zimmer family. When do you get off work? I have to make a few phone calls and some notes. Say an hour? I can squeeze that in, but I may have to leave early. They have a 7-Eleven about 10 miles from your place. I know it's close, but not exactly where. You can follow me, Dan. Let's go. Kathy led them out, or tried to. Chavez beat her out the door and held the point all the way back to the hospital. He and Clark decided to stay outside and get some air, then spotted two youths sitting on their car. It was strange, John Clark thought as he crossed the street. At the beginning, Carolyn Ryan had been the angry one. Angry and betrayed. He'd been the voice of understanding. Now she was feeling much better, though worse in another way. But he had absorbed all of her anger. It was a little too much to bear, and there in front of him was an outlet for it. Off the car, punk! Christ, John, Ding said behind him. Says who? The youth said, hardly turning to see the man approaching. He got his head around just in time to see the hand grasp his shoulder. Then the world rotated, and the brick wall of a building approached his face very rapidly. Fortunately, his boombox absorbed most of the impact, which, however, had a negative effect on the boombox. Motherfucker! The kid snarled, coming out with a knife. His companion was 6 feet away and also had a knife out. Clark just smiled at them. Who's first? The thought of avenging his appliance died a quick death. Both youths knew danger when they saw it. You lucky I don't have my gun, man. You can leave the knives, too. You a cop? No, I am not a policeman, Clark said, walking over with his hand out. Chavez backed him up, his coat opened, as both youths noticed. They dropped their knives and started walking away. What the hell is... Clark turned to see a policeman approaching with a large dog. Both were fully alert. John pulled out his CIA pass. I didn't like their attitude. Chavez handed the knives over. They dropped these, sir.
You really should leave that sort of thing to us.
Yes, sir, Clark agreed. You're right. Nice dog you have there. The cop pocketed the knives.
Have a good one, he said, wondering what the hell this had been about.
You too, officer. Clark paused and turned to Chavez.
God damn, that felt good.
Ready to go to Mexico, John?
Yeah.
I just hate leaving unfinished business behind, you know?
So who's trying to fuck him over?
Not sure.
Bull,
Ding observed. Won't be sure until I talk to Holtzman.
You say so, man.
I like her, he added. That's some lady.
Yeah, she is. Just what he needs to set things straight.
You think she'll call that Murray guy?
Does it matter?
No.
Chavez looked up the street.
A question of honor, Mr. C.
I knew you'd understand, Ding.
Jacqueline Zimmer was a beautiful child, Kathy thought, holding her. She wanted another. Must have another. Jack would give her one. Maybe another girl, if they were lucky.
We hear so much about you, Carol said. You doctor?
Yes. I teach doctors. I'm a professor of surgery.
My oldest son must meet you. He want to be doctor. He's student at Georgetown.
Maybe I can help him a little.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Your husband,
Buck,
he die.
I don't know all the things, just that he die. On duty, yes? His secret thing.
Very hard for me, Carol said soberly, but without overt grief. She was over that now.
Buck was a very good man. So your husband. You be nice to him,
Mrs. Zimmer added. Oh, I will, Kathy promised.
Now, we have to make this a secret.
What secret?
Jack doesn't know that I know about you.
Oh? I know there are many secrets, but...
Okay, I understand. I keep this secret, too. I will talk to Jack about that. I think you should come to our house and meet our children. But for now, we keep the secret?
Yes, okay. We surprise him?
Right.
Kathy smiled as she handed the child back.
I will see you again. Soon.
Feel better, Doc? Clark asked her out in the parking lot.
Thank you.
Call me John.
Thanks, John.
It was the warmest smile since his kids at Christmas. Anytime. Clark drove west on Route 50. Kathy turned east for home. Her knuckles were white on the steering wheel of her car. The anger was back now. For the most part, she was angry at herself. How could she have thought that of Jack? She'd been very foolish, very small, and so disgustingly selfish. But it wasn't really her fault. Someone else had invaded their household, she decided as she pulled into the garage. She was on the phone almost immediately. She had to do one more thing. She had to be completely certain.
Hi, Dan.
Kathy. How's the eye business, kid? Murray asked.
Got a question for you.
Shoot. She'd already decided how to do it.
There's a problem with Jack.
Murray's voice became guarded.
What is it?
He's having nightmares, Kathy said.
It wasn't a lie, but what followed was.
Something about a helicopter and Buck somebody. I can't ask him about it, but...
Murray cut her off. Kathy, I can't talk about it over the phone. That's a business matter, kid.
Really?
Really, Kathy. It's something I know about, but I cannot discuss it with you. I'm sorry, but that's the way it has to be. It's business. Kathy went on with a touch of alarm in her voice. It's not something that's happening now. I mean, it's way in the past, Kathy. That's all I can say. If you think Jack needs professional help, then I can make a few calls and... No, I don't think so. It was really bad a few months ago, but it does seem to be getting better. I was just worried that it might be something at the office. All behind him, Kathy. Honest. You sure, Dan? Positive. I would not kid around on something like this. And that, Kathy knew, was that. Dan was every bit as honest as Jack was. Thanks, Dan. Thanks a lot, she said in her best medical voice, the one that revealed nothing at all. Any time, Kathy. By the time he hung up, Murray wondered if he'd just been had in some way. No, he decided. There was no way she could have found out about that. Had he seen the other end of the disconnected phone line, he would have been surprised to discover how wrong he was. Kathy sat alone in the kitchen, crying one last time. She'd had to check. There had not been a choice to purge all the emotions from her soul, but now she was completely certain that Clark had spoken the truth, that someone was trying to hurt her husband, that whoever it was willing to use his wife and his family against him. Who could ever hate a man so much that they would try that, she wondered. Whoever it was her enemy. Whoever it was had attacked her and her family just as coldly as those terrorists had done, but much more cravenly. Whoever it was would pay for that. Where have you been? Sorry, Doc. I had some errands to run. Clark had come back through the S&T office. Here. What's this? Ryan took the bottle. It was an expensive container of Chivas Regal in a ceramic bottle, the sort you couldn't see through. That's our transceiver. They made up four of them. Nice job, isn't it? Here's the pickup. Clark handed over a green stick, almost the thickness of a cocktail straw, but not quite. It'll look like a plastic doodad to hold the flowers in place. We decided to use three of them. The techies say they can multiplex the outbound transmissions, and for some reason or other they can crunch the computer time down to 1:1. They also say that if we had another few months to play with the comlinks, we could almost real-time the whole thing. What we have is enough, Jack said. Here and now, almost was better than perfect too late. I've funded enough research projects. I agree. What about the test flights? Tomorrow, 10:00. Super. Clark stood. Hey, Doc, how about you call it a day? You look wasted. I think you're right. Give me another hour and I'm out of here. Fair enough. Russell met them at Atlanta. They'd come across through Mexico City, thence through Miami, where the customs people were very interested in drugs, but not particularly interested in Greek businessmen who opened their bags without being asked. Russell, who was now Robert Friend of Rogan, Colorado, with the driver's license to prove it, shook hands with both of them and helped to collect their baggage. Weapons? Cotty asked. Not here, man. I have everything you need at home. Any problems? Not one. Russell was silent for a moment. Maybe there is one. What? Gone asked with concealed alarm. Being on foreign soil always made him nervous, and this was his first trip to America. Cold as hell where we're going, guys. You might want to get some decent coats. That can wait, the commander decided. He was feeling very bad now. The latest batch of chemotherapy had denied him food for nearly 2 days, and as much as he craved nourishment, His stomach rebelled at the mere sight of it in one of the airport fast food stands.
What about our flight?
1.5 hours. How about you get some sweaters, okay? Follow me. I'm not fooling about the weather. It's like 0 where we're going.
0? That is not so...
Gone stopped.
You mean below 0 centigrade?
Russell stopped for a second. Oh, yeah, that's right. 0 here means something different. 0's cold, guys, okay?
As you say, Cotty agreed.
1/2 hour later, they had thick woolen sweaters to go under their thin raincoats. The mostly empty Delta flight to Denver left on time. 3 hours later, they walked off their last jetway for a while. Gone had never seen so much snow in his life.
I can hardly breathe, Cotty said.
It'll take you a day to get used to the altitude. You guys go get the luggage. I'll get the car and warm it up for you.
If he's betrayed us, Cotty said as Russell walked away, we'll know it in the next few minutes.
He has not, Gone replied.
He is a strange man, but a faithful one.
He is an infidel, a pagan.
That is true, but he also listened to an imam in my presence. At least he was polite. I tell you, he is faithful.
We will see, Cotty said, walking tiredly and breathlessly to the baggage claim level. Both men looked around as they moved, searching for eyes. That was always the giveaway, the eyes that fixed on you. It was hard even for the most professional of men to keep from looking at their targets. They collected their luggage without incident, and Marvin was waiting. He could not stop the blast of air from hitting them, and thin as the air was, it was also colder than either had ever experienced. The heat of the car was welcome indeed.
How go the preparations?
Everything is on schedule, Commander, Russell said. He drove off. The Arabs were quietly impressed by the vast open space, the broad interstate highway. They found the speed limit signs very strange, and the obvious wealth in the area. They were also impressed with Russell, who had manifestly done quite well. Both men rested easier that he had not betrayed them. It was not that Cotty had actually expected it, rather that he knew that his vulnerability increased as they got closer to the final part of the plan. That, he knew, was normal. The farm was of a good size. Russell had thoughtfully overheated it somewhat, but what Cotty noted most of all was its obvious defensibility, with a clear field of fire in all directions. He got them inside and carried the bags for them.
You guys have to be pretty tired, Marvin observed. Why don't you just bed down? You're safe here, okay?
Cotty took the advice. Gone did not. He and Russell went to the kitchen. Ibrahim was happy to learn that Marvin was a skilled cook.
What is this meat?
Venison. Deer meat. I know you can't eat pork, but you got any problems with deer? The American asked.
Gone shook his head.
No, but I have never had it.
It's okay, I promise. I found this at a local store this morning. Native American soul food, man. This is good mule deer. There's a game rancher around here who grows them commercially. I can try you out on beefalo, too.
What the devil is that?
Beefalo? Another thing you can only get around here. It's a cross between beef cattle and buffalo. Buffalo is what my people used to eat, man. Biggest damn cow you're ever gonna see.
Russell grinned. Good lean meat, healthy and everything. But venison's the best, Ibrahim.
You must not call me that, Gone said tiredly.
It had been a 27-hour day for him, counting the time zones.
I got the IDs for you and the commander.
Russell pulled the envelopes from a drawer and tossed them on the table. Names are exactly what you wanted, see? We just have to do the photos and put them on the cards. I have the equipment to do it.
Was this hard to get?
Marvin laughed.
Nah, it's standard commercial stuff.
I used my own license form as a master, ginned up the copies, then I got the hardware to do first-class dupes. Lots of companies use photo passes, and the equipment is standardized. 3 hours' work. I figure we have all day tomorrow and day after to go over everything.
Excellent, Marvin.
You want a drink?
Alcohol, you mean?
Hey, man, I saw you have a beer with that German guy. What was his name?
Herr Fromm, you mean?
Come on. It's not as bad as eating pork, is it?
Thank you. But I will pass on that. Is that how you say it?
Pass on the drink? Yeah, that's fine, man. How's that Fromm guy doing? Marvin asked casually, looking at the meat. It was almost done.
Doing well, Gone answered just as casually. He went off to see his wife.
Exactly what were you guys working on anyway? Russell poured himself a shot of Jack Daniels.
He helped us with the explosives. Some special tricks, you see. He's an expert in the field.
Great. It was the first hopeful sign in a few days. Maybe a few weeks, Ryan thought. Dinner was fine. All the better to make it home in time to have it with the kids. Kathy had evidently gotten home from work at a reasonable hour and had taken the time to fix a good one. Best of all, they'd talked over dinner. Not about very much, but they'd talked. Afterwards, Jack had helped her clean up. Finally, the kids went off to bed, and they were alone.
I'm sorry I snapped at you, Kathy said.
It's okay. I guess I deserved it. Ryan was willing to say almost anything to calm things down.
No, I was wrong, Jack. I was feeling bitchy, and I had cramps and my back hurt. What's wrong with you is that you're working too hard and drinking too much. She came over to kiss him. Smoking, Jack?
He was amazed. He hadn't expected to be kissed. More than that, he expected an explosion if she discovered that he'd smoked. Sorry, babe. Bad day at the office. I wimped. Kathy held his hands.
Jack, I want you to cut back on the drinking and get your rest. That's your problem. That and stress. We'll worry about the smoking later. Just so you don't smoke around the kids. I haven't been very sympathetic, and I've been a little wrong myself. But you have to clean up your act. What you've been doing is bad for you, and bad for us.
I know.
Go to bed. You need sleep more than anything else.
Being married to a physician had its drawbacks. Chief among those was that you couldn't argue with one. Jack kissed her on the cheek, and did as he was told.
Chapter 30, East Room. Clark arrived at the house at the proper time and had to do something unusual. He waited. After a couple of minutes, he was ready to knock on the door, but then it opened. Dr. Ryan, male, came out part way, then stopped and turned to kiss Dr. Ryan, female, who watched him walk off and, after his back was fully turned, fired off a beaming smile at the car. All right, Clark thought. Maybe he did have a new career set up. Jack also looked fairly decent, and Clark told him so as soon as he got in the car. Yeah, well, I got sent to bed early, Jack chuckled, tossing his paper on the front seat. Forgot to have a drink, too. Couple more days like that, and you just might be human again. Maybe you're right. But he still lit up a cigarette, somewhat to Clark's annoyance. Then he realized just how smart Carolyn Ryan was. One thing at a time. Damn, Clark told himself. That is some broad. I'm set up for the test flight. 10 o'clock. Good. It is nice to put you to some real work, John. Playing SPO must be boring as hell, Ryan said, opening the dispatch box. It has its moments, sir, Clark replied, pulling onto Falcon's Nest Road. It was another quiet day on the dispatches, and soon Ryan had his head buried in the Morning Post. 3 hours later, Clark and Chavez arrived at Andrews Air Force Base. A pair of VC-20Bs had already been scheduled for routine training flights. The pilots and crews of the 89th Military Airlift, the President's Wing, had a strict regimen for maintaining proficiency. The two aircraft took off a few minutes apart and headed east to perform various familiarization maneuvers to acquaint two new co-pilots with air traffic control procedures, which the drivers already knew backwards and forwards, of course, but that was beside the point. In the back, an Air Force technical sergeant was doing his own training, playing with the sophisticated communications equipment that the plane carried. He occasionally looked aft to see that civilian, whoever the hell he was, talking into a flower pot, or just into a little green stick. There are some things, the sergeant thought, that a guy just isn't supposed to understand. He was entirely correct. 2 hours later, the two Gulfstreams landed back at Andrews and rolled to a halt at the VIP terminal. Clark gathered up his gear and walked out to meet another civilian who'd been aboard the other aircraft. The pair walked off to their car, already talking.
I could understand part of what you were saying.
Clear, I mean, Chavez reported.
Say about a third of it, maybe a little less.
Okay, we'll see what the techies can do with it.
The drive back to Langley took 35 minutes, and from there Clark and Chavez drove back into Washington for a late lunch.
Bob Holtzman had gotten a call the previous evening. It had come on his unlisted home line. A curt, short message. It had also piqued his interest. At 2 p.m, he walked into a small Mexican place in Georgetown called Esteban's. Most of the business crowd had gone, leaving the place about a third full, mainly with kids from Georgetown University. A wave from the back told him where to go.
Hello, Holtzman said, sitting down.
You Holtzman?
That's right, the reporter said.
And you are?
Two friendly guys, the older one said.
Join us for lunch?
Okay. The younger one got up and started feeding quarters into a jukebox that played Mexican music. In a moment, it was certain that his tape recorder wouldn't have a chance of working.
What do you want to see me about?
You've been writing some pieces on the agency, the older one started off. The target of your articles is the deputy director, Dr. John Ryan.
I never said that, Holtzman replied.
Whoever leaked all that shit to you lied.
It's a setup.
Says who?
Just how honest a reporter are you?
What do you mean? Holtzman asked.
If I tell you something totally off the record, will you print it?
That depends on the nature of the information. What exactly is your intention?
What I mean, Mr. Holtzman, is that I can prove to you that you've been lied to, but the proof of that can never be revealed. It would endanger some people. It would also prove that somebody's been using you to grind an axe or two. I want to know who that person is.
You know that I can never reveal a source. That violates our code of ethics.
Ethics in a reporter, the man said just loudly enough to be heard over the music. I like that. Do you also protect sources who lie to you?
No, we don't do that.
Okay. Then I'm going to tell you a little story, but the condition is that you may never, ever reveal what I am going to tell you. Will you honor such a condition?
What if I find out you are misleading me?
Then you will be free to print it.
Fair enough. Clark got a nod. Just remember, I will be very unhappy if you ever print it, 'cause I ain't lying. One more thing. You can't ever use what I'm going to tell you as a lead to do your own digging.
That's asking a lot.
You make the call, Mr. Holtzman. You have the reputation of an honest reporter and a pretty smart one. There are some things that can't be reported.
Well, that's going too far. Let's say that there are things that have to remain secret for a very long time, like years. What I'm getting at is this. You've been used.
You have been conned into printing lies in order to hurt someone. Now, I'm not a reporter, but if I were, that would bother me. It would bother me because it's wrong, and it would bother me because someone took me for a sucker. You have it figured out. Okay, I agree to your conditions. Fair enough. Clark told his story. It took 10 minutes. What about the mission? Where exactly did the man die? Sorry, pal. And you can forget about finding that one out. Less than 10 people can answer that. Clark's lie was a clever one. If you even manage to figure out who they are, they won't talk. They can't. Not too many people voluntarily leak information about breaking laws. And the Zimmer woman? You can check out most of that story. Where she lives, the family business, where the kid was born, who was there, who the doctor was. Holtzman checked his notes. There's something really, really big behind all this, isn't there? Clark just stared at him. All I want is a name. What will you do with it? Nothing that concerns you. What will Ryan do with it? He doesn't know we're here. Bullshit. That, Mr. Holtzman, is the truth. Bob Holtzman had been a reporter a very long time. He'd been lied to by experts. He'd been the target of very organized and well-planned lies, had been the instrument of political vendettas. He didn't like that part of his job, not in the least. The contempt he felt for politicians came mainly from their willingness to break any rule. Whenever a politician broke his word, told the most outrageous of lies, took money from a contributor and left the room at once to perform a service for that contributor, it was called just politics. That was wrong, and Holtzman knew it. There was still in him something of the idealist who had graduated from Columbia's journalism school, and though life had made him a cynic, he was one of those few people in Washington who remembered his ideals and occasionally mourned for them. Assuming I can verify this story you've told, what's in it for me? Maybe just satisfaction. Maybe nothing more than that. I honestly doubt there will be any more, but if there is, I'll let you know. Just satisfaction? Holtzman asked. Ever want to get even with a bully? Clark asked lightly. The reporter brushed that aside. What do you do at the agency? Clark smiled. I'm really not supposed to talk about that. Once upon a time, the story goes, a very senior Soviet official defected, right off the tarmac at Moscow Airport. I've heard that story. If you ever printed it. Yes, it would fuck up relations, wouldn't it? Holtzman observed. How long have you had it?
Since right before the last election.
The president asked me not to run it.
Fowler, you mean?
No, the one Fowler beat.
And you played ball.
Clark was impressed.
The man had a family, a wife and a daughter. Were they killed in a plane crash, like the press release said?
You ever going to print this?
I can't, not for a lot of years. But someday I'm going to do a book.
They got out, too. Clark said. You're looking at the guy who got them out of the country.
I don't believe in coincidences.
The wife's name is Maria. The daughter's name is Catherine.
Holtzman didn't react, but he knew that only a handful of people in the agency could possibly have known the details to that one. He'd just asked his own trick question and gotten the right answer.
5 years from today, I want the details of the bust out.
Clark was quiet for a moment. Well, if the reporter was willing to break a rule, then Clark had to play ball, too.
That's fair. Okay, you have a deal.
Jesus Christ, John,
Chavez said.
The man needs a quid pro quo.
How many people inside know the details?
Of the operation? Not many. My end. If you mean all the details, maybe 20. And only 5 of them are still in the agency. 10 of them are not agency employees. Then who? That would give too much away. Air Force Special Ops, Holtzman said. Or maybe the Army, Task Force 160. Those crazy guys at Fort Campbell, the ones that went into Iraq the first night. You can speculate all you want, but I'm not going to say anything. I will say this, when I tell you my end, I want to know how the hell you figured out that we even had this operation.
People like to talk, Holtzman said simply.
True enough. Do we have a deal, sir?
If I can verify what you've told me, if I'm sure I've been lied to, yes, I will reveal the source. You have to promise that it will never get to the press.
Jesus, this is like diplomacy, Clark reflected. Agreed. I'll call you in 2 days. For what it's worth, you're the first reporter I've ever talked to.
So what do you think?
Holtzman asked with a grin. I think I ought to stick with spooks. John paused. You might have been a pretty good one.
I am a pretty good one.
Just how heavy is this thing? Russell asked.
700 kilos. Gone did the mental arithmetic. 3/4 of a ton. Your ton, that is.
Okay, Russell said. The truck'll handle that. How do we get it from the truck into my truck? The question turned Gone pale.
I had not considered that.
How was it loaded on?
The box is set on a wooden platform.
You mean a pallet? They put it in with a forklift?
Yes, Gone said. That is correct.
You're lucky. Come on, I'll show you. Russell led the man out into the cold. 2 minutes later, he saw that one of the barns had a concrete loading dock and a rusty propane-powered forklift. The only bad news was that the dirt path leading up to it was covered with snow and frozen mud. How delicate is the bomb?
Bombs can be very delicate, Marvin, Gone pointed out.
Russell had a good laugh at that one.
Yeah,
I guess so. It was fully 10 hours earlier in Syria. Dr. Vladimir Moseyevich Kaminsky had just started work, early as was his custom. A professor at Moscow State University, he'd been sent to Syria to teach in his specialty, which was respiratory problems. It was not a specialty to make a man an optimist. Much of what he saw in the Soviet Union and also here in Syria was lung cancer, a disease as preventable as it was lethal. His first case of the day had been referred by a Syrian practitioner whom he admired. The man was French-trained and very thorough, and also one who only referred interesting cases. On entering the examining room, Kaminsky found a fit-looking man in his early 30s. A closer look showed someone with a gray, drawn face. His first impression was cancer. But Kaminsky was a careful man. It could be something else. Something contagious. His examination took longer than he'd expected, necessitating several X-ray films and some additional tests. But he was called back to the Soviet embassy before the results arrived. It required all of Clark's patience, but he let it go almost 3 days on the assumption that Holtzman didn't get right on the case. John left his house at 8:30 in the evening and drove to a gas station. There he told the attendant to fill up the car. He hated pumping it himself, and walked over to the payphone.
Yeah, Holtzman said, answering his unlisted line.
Clark didn't identify himself. You have a chance to run the facts down?
Yeah, as a matter of fact.
Got most of them anyway.
Looks like you were right.
Really is annoying when people lie to you, isn't it?
Who?
I call her Liz. The president calls her Elizabeth.
Want a freebie? Holtzman added.
Sure. Call this evidence of good faith on my part. Fowler and she are getting it on. Nobody's reported it because we figure it's not the public's business.
Good for you, Clark observed.
Thanks.
I owe you one.
5 years, man. I'll be around. Clark hung up. So, John thought. I thought that's who it was. He dropped another quarter in the phone. He got lucky on the first try. It was a woman's voice. Hello?
Dr. Carolyn Ryan?
Yes, who's this?
The name you wanted, ma'am, is Elizabeth Elliot, the president's national security advisor. Clark decided not to add the other part. It was not relevant to the situation, was it?
You're sure?
Yes.
Thank you.
The line clicked off. Kathy had sent Jack to bed early again. The man was being sensible. Well, that wasn't a surprise, was it? She thought. After all, he married me. The timing could have been a little better. A few days earlier, she had planned to skip the official dinner, claiming work as an excuse. But now, how do I do this?
Morning, Bernie, Kathy Ryan said as she scrubbed her hands, as usual, all the way to the elbows.
Hi, Kath. How's it going?
A lot better, Bernie.
Really? Dr. Katz started scrubbing.
Really?
Glad to hear it, Katz observed dubiously. Kathy finished, shutting off the water with taps from her elbows.
Bernie, it turns out I overreacted rather badly.
What about the guy who came to see me? Katz asked, his head down.
It was not true. I can't explain now. Maybe some other time. Need a favor?
Sure, what?
The cornea replacement I have scheduled for Wednesday. Can you take it?
What gives?
Jack and I have to go to a formal dinner in the White House tomorrow night. State dinner for the Prime Minister of Finland, would you believe? The procedure is straightforward. No complications I know about. I can have you the file this afternoon. Jenkins is going to do the procedure. I'm just supposed to ride shotgun.
Jenkins was a bright young resident.
Okay, I'll do it.
Okay, thanks.
Owe you one, Kathy said on her way through the door. The Carmen Vita pulled into Hampton Roads barely an hour late. She turned to port and proceeded south past the Navy piers. The captain and pilot rode the portside bridge wing, noting the carrier that was even now departing from the pier with a few hundred wives and children waving goodbye to USS Theodore Roosevelt. Two cruisers, two destroyers, and a frigate were already moving. They, the pilot explained, were the screening ships for the Stick, as TR was called by her crew. The Indian-born captain grunted and returned to business. Half an hour later, the container ship approached her pier at the end of Terminal Boulevard. Three tugs took their position and eased the Carmen Vita alongside. The ship had barely been tied up when the gantry cranes started moving cargo.
Rogan, Colorado? The trucker asked. He flipped open his large book map and looked on I-76 for the right place.
Okay, I see it.
How fast? Russell asked.
From the time I leave here? 1,800 miles. Oh, 2 days, maybe 40 hours if I'm lucky.
Gonna cost you.
How much? Russell asked. The trucker told him.
Cash all right?
Cash is fine.
I knocked 10% off for that, the trucker said. The IRS never found out about cash transactions.
Half in advance.
Russell peeled off the bills.
Half on delivery. A grand bonus if you break 40 hours.
Sounds good to me. What about the box?
You bring that right back here. We'll be getting more stuff in a month, Russell lied. We can make this a sort of regular run for you.
Sounds good to me.
Russell returned to his friends, and together they watched the unloading process from the comfort of a block building with a large coffee urn. Teddy Roosevelt cleared the harbor in record time, bending on 20 knots before they reached the sea buoy. Already the aircraft were orbiting overhead, first among them the F-14 Tomcat fighters that had lifted off from Oceana Naval Air Station. As soon as there was sea room, the carrier came into the northerly wind to commence flight operations.
The first plane down had the 00 number of the CAG, Captain Robbie Jackson. His Tomcat caught a gust over the fantail, and as a result caught the number 2 wire when it landed, trapped somewhat to Jackson's annoyance. The next aircraft, flown by Commander Rafael Sanchez, made a perfect trap on the number 3 arrestor wire. Both aircraft taxied out of harm's way. Jackson left the fighter and immediately sprinted to his place on Vulture's Row, high up on the carrier's island structure, so that he could observe the arrival of the rest of his aircraft. This was how a deployment started, with the CAG and squadron commanders watching their troops land. Each trap would be recorded on videotape for critiques. The crews had not gotten off to a very good start, Jackson noted as he sipped his first mug of shipboard coffee. He'd missed his customary okay grade, as the air boss had informed him with a twinkling eye.
"Hey, Skipper, how my kids doing?" Sanchez asked, taking his seat behind Robbie.
"Not bad. I see you kept your record going, bud."
"It's not hard, Captain. You just keep an eye on the wind as you turn in. I saw that gust you took. Guess I should have warned you."
"Pride goeth before the fall, Commander," Robbie observed. Sanchez had 17 consecutive okays. Maybe he could see the wind, Jackson thought. 70 uneventful minutes later, TR turned back east, taking the Great Circle route for the Strait of Gibraltar.
The trucker made sure the container box was firmly secured to the bed of his truck, then climbed into the cab of his Kenworth diesel tractor. He started his engine and waved to Russell, who waved back.
"I still think we should follow him," Gone said.
"He'd notice and wonder why," Marvin replied. "And if something goes wrong, what would you do? Fill in the hole that makes in the highway? You didn't follow the ship, did you?"
"True."
Gone looked at Cotty and shrugged. Then they walked off to their car for the drive to Charlotte, from which they would fly directly to Denver. Jack was ready early, as he usually was, but Kathy took her time. It was so unusual for her to look in a mirror and see hair that looked like it belonged to a real woman, as opposed to a surgeon who didn't give a damn. That had entailed the waste of 2 hours, but there were prices that one had to pay. Before she went downstairs, Kathy took 2 suitcases out from her closet and set them in the middle of the bedroom.
"Here, can you do this?" she asked her husband.
"Sure, babe."
Ryan took the gold necklace and clasped it around her neck. It was one he'd given her on the Christmas before little Jack was born. Some good memories went along with this necklace, Jack remembered. Then he stood back. "Turn around." Kathy did as she was told. Her evening dress was royal blue silk that caught and reflected light like glass. Jack Ryan was not a man who understood women's fashions. Figuring the Russians out came more easily to him, but he approved whatever the new rules were. The rich blue of the dress and the gold jewelry she wore with it set off the blush of her fair skin and the buttery yellow of her hair.
"Nice," Jack said. "All ready, babe?"
"Sure am, Jack."
She smiled back at him.
"Go warm the car up."
Kathy watched him head out into the garage, then said a few words to the sitter. She put on her fur, surgeons typically have little use for animal rights activists, and followed Jack a minute later. Jack backed out of the garage and headed off. Clark had to laugh to himself. Ryan still didn't know beans about counter-surveillance techniques. He watched the taillights of the car diminish, then disappear entirely around the bend of the road before heading into the Ryan driveway.
"You're Mr. Clark?" the sitter asked.
"That's right."
"They're in the bedroom,"
the sitter pointed.
"Thank you."
Clark returned a minute later.
"Typical woman," he thought. "They all overpack. Even Carolyn Ryan wasn't perfect. Good night."
"Night."
The sitter was already entranced with the TV. It takes just under an hour to drive from Annapolis, Maryland, into central D.C. Ryan missed having an official car, but his wife had insisted that they drive themselves. They turned off of Pennsylvania Avenue through the gate into East Executive Drive, where uniformed police directed them to a parking place. Their wagon looked a little humble, mixed in with caddies and Lincolns, but that was all right with Jack. The Bryans walked up the gentle slope to the east entrance, where Secret Service personnel checked their invitations against the guest list and checked them off. Jack's car keys set off the metal detector, evoking an embarrassed smile. No matter how many times one goes there, there is always something magical about visiting the White House, especially at night. Ryan led his wife westward. They handed off their coats and took their numbered token right next to the White House's own small theater, then continued. At the chicane turn, there were the usual three social reporters, women in their 60s who stared you in the face while making their notes and generally looked like the witches from Macbeth with their open mouth, drooly smiles. Officers from all the military services decked out in their full dress, what Ryan used to call headwaiter uniforms, waited in files to provide escort duty. As usual, the Marines looked best with their scarlet sashes, and a disgustingly good-looking captain motioned them up the stairs to the main level. Jack noted the admiring glance cast at his wife, and decided to smile about it. At the top of the marble stairs, another officer, this one a female army lieutenant, directed them into the east room. They were announced into the room, as though anyone were listening, and a liveried usher approached at once with a silver tray of drinks. "You're driving, Jack," Kathy whispered. Jack took a Perrier and a twist. Kathy got champagne. The east room of the White House is the size of a small gymnasium. The walls are ivory white, its false columns decorated with gold leaf. There was a string quartet in one corner, along with a grand piano that was being played rather well, Ryan thought, by an army sergeant. Half the people were already here, the men in black tie and the women in dresses. Perhaps there were people who were totally comfortable at such affairs, Ryan told himself, but he wasn't one of them. He started circulating, and soon found Defense Secretary Bunker and his wife Charlotte. "Hello, Jack." "Hi, Dennis. You know my wife?" "Carolyn," Kathy said, sticking her hand out. "So, what do you think about the game?" Jack laughed. "Sir, I know how you and Brent Talbot have been fighting over this. I was born in Baltimore. Somebody stole our team." "You didn't lose that much, did you? This is our year." "But the Vikings say the same thing. They were lucky to get past New York." "The Raiders gave you a brief scare, as I recall." "They got lucky," Bunker grumbled. "We buried them in the second half." Carolyn Ryan and Charlotte Bunker traded a woman-to-woman look. "Football." Kathy turned, and there she was. Mrs. Bunker made off while the boys talked about boy things. Kathy took a deep breath. She wondered if this was the right time and the right place, but she could no more have stopped herself now than she could have given up surgery. She left Jack facing the other way and headed across the floor in a line as direct as a falcon's. Dr. Elizabeth Elliott was dressed almost identically to Dr. Carolyn Ryan. The cuts and pleats were a little different, but the expensive garments were close enough to make a fashion editor wonder if they had shopped at the same store. A triple string of pearls graced her neck, and she was talking with two others. Her head turned as she saw the approaching shape. "Hello, Dr. Elliott. You remember me?" Kathy asked with a warm smile. "No. Should I?" "Carolyn Ryan. That help?" "Sorry," Liz replied, knowing at once who she was, but not knowing anything else that might be of interest. "Do you know Bob and Libby Holtzman?" "I've read your material," Kathy said, taking Holtzman's extended hand. "It's always nice to hear that." Holtzman noted the delicacy of her touch and could feel the guilt shoot up his arm. Was this the woman whose marriage he had attacked? "This is Libby." "You're a reporter, too," Kathy observed. Libby Holtzman was taller than she, and dressed in an outfit that emphasized her ample bosom. "One of hers is worth both of mine," Kathy noted, managing not to sigh. Libby had the sort of bust on which men yearn to lay their heads. "You operated on a cousin of mine a year or so ago," Libby Holtzman said. "Her mom says you're the best surgeon in the world." "All doctors love to hear that." Kathy decided that she would like Mrs. Holtzman, despite her physical handicap. "I know you're a surgeon. But where have we met? Liz Elliott asked, with the offhand interest she might have shown a dog breeder.
Bennington. In my freshman year, you taught Poli-Sci 101.
Is that a fact?
I'm surprised you remember.
She made it clear that she did not.
Yes.
Well, you know how it is.
Kathy smiled.
Freshman pre-med is a real bear. We really have to concentrate on the important stuff. So the unimportant courses are all throwaways, easy A's.
Elliot's expression didn't change.
I was never an easy grader.
Sure you were.
It was just a matter of repeating it all back to you.
Kathy smiled even more broadly.
Bob Holtzman was tempted to take a step back, but managed not to move at all. His wife's eyes went a touch wider, having caught the signals more quickly than her husband. A war had just begun. It would be nastier than most.
Whatever happened to Dr. Brooks?
Who? Liz asked. Kathy turned to the Holtzmans. Times really were different back in the 70s, weren't they? Dr. Elliott just had her master's, and the poli-sci department was, well, kind of radical. You know, the fashionable kind.
She turned back.
Surely you haven't forgotten Dr. Brooks and Dr. Hemmings. Where was that house you shared with them?
I don't remember.
Liz told herself to maintain control. This would all be over soon. But she couldn't walk away.
Wasn't it on that three-way corner, a few blocks from the campus?
We used to call them the Marx Brothers, Kathy explained with a giggle.
Brooks never wore socks. In Vermont, remember, he must have gotten terrible colds from that. And Hemmings never washed his hair. That was some department. Of course, Dr. Brooks went off to Berkeley, and then you went out there, too, to finish your doctorate.
I guess you liked working under him.
Tell me, how is Bennington now?
Just as nice as ever.
I never get back there for the alum meetings, Kathy said.
I haven't been back there myself in over a year, Liz replied.
Whatever happened to Dr. Brooks? Kathy asked again.
He teaches at Vassar now, I think.
Oh, you've kept track of him.
Still trying to bed every skirt in sight, too, I bet.
Radical chic. How often do you see him?
Not in a couple of years.
We never understood what you saw in them, Kathy observed.
Come now, Carolyn. None of us were virgins back then.
Kathy sipped at her champagne.
That's true. Times were different, and we did lots of very dumb things. But I got lucky. Jack made an honest woman of me.
Zing, Libby Holtzman thought.
Some of us haven't had time.
I don't know how you manage without a family. I don't think I could handle the loneliness.
At least I never have to worry about an unfaithful husband, Liz observed icily, finding her own weapon, not knowing it wasn't loaded anymore.
Kathy looked amused.
Yes, I suppose some women have to worry about that. But I don't, thank God.
How can any woman be sure?
Only a fool is unsure.
If you know your man, Kathy explained, you know what he can and cannot do.
And you really feel that secure? Liz asked.
Of course.
They say the wife is always the last to know.
Kathy's head cocked to one side.
Is this a philosophical discussion? Or are you trying to say something to my face instead of behind my back?
Jesus!
Bob Holtzman felt that he was a spectator at a prize fight.
Did I give you that impression?
Oh, I'm so sorry, Carolyn.
That's okay, Liz.
Excuse me, but I prefer...
I go by Professor Two. You know, medical doctor, Johns Hopkins and all that.
I thought you were an associate professor.
Dr. Ryan nodded.
That's right. I got offered a full professorship at the University of Virginia, but that meant moving away from the house we like, moving the kids out of school. And, of course, there's the problem with Jack's career. So I turned it down.
I guess you are
pretty tied down. I do have responsibilities, and I like working at Hopkins. We're doing some pioneer work, and it's good to be where the action is. It must have been much easier for you to come to Washington, but with nothing to hold you in.